I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Lawmakers are scrambling to react to President Trump's late-night video announcing his disdain for the $900 billion relief bill hammered out by members of Congress and his own Treasury Secretary and then passed by a large bipartisan majority. Trump called it a disgrace.
It's called the COVID relief bill, but it has almost nothing to do with COVID.
And President Trump is now calling on Congress to amend the bill, including replacing the $600 relief checks with much larger ones of $2,000 per person. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's senior political correspondent. And Domenico, we know President Trump was absent from these negotiations. He was focusing on trying to overturn the election. Can he veto this? What's going on here?
Well, this is a very complex matter, obviously. This is the last train out of Dodge, essentially, of the Trump presidency. So what he's talking about there in that clip about this having little to do with COVID is not true. You know, there's a $900 billion COVID relief package that includes $600 in direct payments to people as well as a host of other things. But paired with that is a $1.4 trillion larging spending package that's referred to on Capitol Hill as the omnibus. And that creates a $2.3 trillion total package with you know, 5,500 pages or so of things to read. And that other portion includes things like military pay raises, increased money for veterans, border security funding, addressing surprise medical billing, money for the Smithsonian Museums, for American Women's History, and for American Latinos Museum. Like, there's just a whole bunch of stuff in this because it takes a very long time sometimes for these committees to negotiate all of this, and they finally got something done. The president, as you noted, has had a liaison with the Treasury Secretary involved in these talks for months and now throws this grenade in here, threatening to derail the process. And to answer your question directly, yes, he could veto this bill, they may have a veto-proof majority, but they would have to come back and vote on that. And as we know, members are home for the holidays, and Democrats now are saying that they will, you know, they're on board with the $2,000 measure, which is a little bit of trolling from them, but they're going to bring it to the floor, they say, tomorrow for unanimous consent, because they'll be in what's called a pro forma session. But everyone won't be there. And if there's one objection from any Republicans, it won't pass. So this is a complete mess, and no one's exactly sure how we get out of this.
Well, what does this do to Republicans, especially Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, who negotiated the $600 amount or was instrumental in that?
Well, look, it's not the first time that the president has undercut and undermined people in his administration. You know, I think that he thinks that there's some populist, advantage for him to say that this bill is too low and that there's wasteful spending on a whole bunch of other things. And by him muddying that water, his supporters can say, oh, look at the mess the swamp has created, rather than seeing it for what it is, which is the president not having been involved in these negotiations and now upending the entire process when Republican leaders thought that they had a deal.
Okay, just briefly, does this mean the thing that most people care about the most, does this mean that checks won't be going out as soon as next week?
it's not clear. You know, we have to see how quickly they can amend any of this, or if President Trump is bluffing and winds up signing the thing at the end of the day, if somebody gets in his ear and, you know, he grudgingly signs it, otherwise to be, you know, looked at as something of a Grinch for these holidays.
Right. We only have a few seconds. We know this video last night came almost coinciding with clemency that the president gave 20 people, including many allies, Blackwater guards who were convicted for participating in the killing of Iraqi civilians. Your thoughts just briefly on that. We'll take it up elsewhere.
Well, he's certainly shown the willingness to pardon his friends and allies and those who remain loyal to him, and he's doing that again. And he's certainly shown a heavy hand when it comes especially to those Blackwater employees who were convicted of their actions in 2007.
Yeah, and they worked for a company owned by Education Secretary Betsy Voss's brother, so questions there. NPR senior political correspondent Domenico Montanaro, lots to chew over. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, as we know, there have been protests across the country this year against police brutality, and some law enforcement officers of color have been patrolling those protests with a foot in two camps. Many empathize with the movement and have felt racism themselves at the hands of police. But they've chosen to try to change police culture from within. Colorado Public Radio's Allison Sherry reports.
The officers of color I talked with all had their own stories of police discrimination while out of uniform. In El Paso County, I sat with three black officers from the sheriff's department. I asked about whether they'd ever had a bad experience with law enforcement.
You want details?
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
I've been stopped numerous times for no reason whatsoever.
That's Cliff Northam. He's a bureau chief in the El Paso County Sheriff's Department, and he's been in uniform for almost 40 years. He told the story of one harrowing time he was stopped by police because they said he fit a suspect description.
I was minding my own business in that area, and I was pulled over, taken out of the car at gunpoint, put down on my knees, searched, and they asked who I was, where I was coming from, saw the gun that I was wearing, which sort of scared me because I said, I have a gun. And then I heard yelling, he's got a gun. I said, I also have a badge. And, you know, I had to quickly get that out because when I heard he's got a gun, I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to get shot.
During that entire episode, Northam's young son was in the car. He wept throughout the arrest. His son is now a Black Lives Matter organizer and faces felony charges for allegedly blocking a police station during a protest. Chief Northam is proud of his son, and he says he understands how the anger can build over time. He uses his own story of the felony stop for racial bias trainings for other officers.
I also understand that there are some people out there where that happens over and over and over and over again, and the frustration just builds and builds until, okay, this next time they jump out of the car, they start cussing, they're upset, they maybe walk a little too fast towards an officer and it becomes a use of force or, God forbid, a shooting.
I talked to several Black and Latino law enforcement officers across Colorado about what it's like to be an officer right now and how the police brutality movement has sparked change. All of them agreed there needs to be police reform. Sergeant Carla Havard has been at the Denver Police Department since the 1990s.
Where you been? You been staying out of trouble?
I'm trying. Way out here.
On a recent day, Havard stopped at a restaurant to meet a friend she's had in the community for a long time. A woman she met on the job who needed help once. The woman wanted to immediately talk about the protest movement.
That's my point. We've been talking about doing things.
That's because
for 450 years.
Havard takes a big picture view of the problem.
It's the basic evil that's at the center of it, and that's racism. And I think we haven't figured out an answer for that.
Havard says she's experienced racism herself. She's been trailed around a department store by security guards. And she's patrolled police brutality protests downtown, where she's been called names because she's a law enforcement officer.
Law enforcement in general, historically, has not treated brown and black communities fairly. We know that. You know, we want to engage in those relationships so our officers can, A, understand that these people, and I hate that word, these people are you. Because when we take off this uniform, we're not that much different. Everyone wants to be happy, healthy, and safe.
Denver officer Reyes Trujillo has patrolled the city's neighborhoods since the 1990s and says what's happening now is palpable on the streets.
As we're walking down the street, people will feel more emboldened to flip us off.
Trujillo has lived through the peaks and valleys of police popularity. After 9/11, people bought him lunches and coffees, thanked him for his service. And now?
They'll tell us, you know, that we're killers, and have we killed any black people recently? Obviously, for somebody that's trying to do the right thing on a daily basis and keep an even mentality all of the time, yeah, it's challenging and it's hurtful, really.
El Paso County Sheriff's Deputy Edwin Wilson says some people are treating him differently on the job since George Floyd's death in Minnesota. Recently, he stopped an African-American driver for speeding on an interstate.
He told me, he's like, well, being a young black man in America, I was scared.
Wilson, who is also black, says he was surprised and kind of hurt to hear that. He pressed the driver on what he meant by that comment. What bad experience had this man had with police?
He said his cousin was shot by a cop. And I apologize. Hey, man, I don't know that situation. I don't know the story. Regardless, apologizing, hey, I can't fix that. I can't bring your cousin back.
Most of the officers I spoke to say they're trying to use their unique perspectives to push for reform inside their agencies. Sergeant Havard says she's proud to work in Denver, where the department has instilled more implicit bias training.
You can fix something from the outside or from the inside. I'm choosing to fix it from the inside. I would love more minorities to be a part of the profession. You want to fix it? Come help me fix it from within.
The tension many of these officers feel, both personally and professionally, was apparent in the hours I spent with them. They're having the conversations, inside and outside their departments. And all of them were clear. They're eager to see law enforcement do what's needed to gain the community's trust. For Here and Now, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
The coronavirus pandemic has affected almost every aspect of our lives this year, the way plagues have always done throughout human history, and it will continue to shape society for years to come. Joining us now is Nicholas Christakis. He's a physician and sociologist at Yale and author of the new book Apollo's Arrow, The Profound and Enduring Impact of Coronavirus on the Way We Live. Nicholas Christakis, welcome.
Peter, thank you so much for having me.
So vaccines are out the door, and it seems like we are at an important inflection point in this crisis. How close are we to the end of the pandemic?
Oh, goodness. I wish I could, join you in this tremendous enthusiasm. I mean, it is miraculous that we have manufactured or invented, rather, a vaccine. Plagues are an ancient threat. They have been a part of our history on this planet for thousands of years. We are not the first people alive to face this ancient threat, but we are the first generation ever to face it at a time when we can manufacture a specific countermeasure like a vaccine in real time. So it's a miracle, truly, and unprecedented that we have accomplished this. But I don't think that the vaccine heralds a rapid end to this pandemic, unfortunately.
Okay, no, I'm glad to know that, at least to be prepared. People should be prepared. And so to that point, walk us through how you think the next year or so, maybe longer, will go, especially as we need to get closer and closer to this concept known as herd immunity.
Herd immunity is an interesting idea from epidemiology. It's the claim that a population of people can be immune to a condition, even if not every individual within that population is immune. So, for example, if you vaccinate 96% of the population for measles, if one of the 4% of people who's not vaccinated gets measles, that individual can't find anyone to spread it to. They're surrounded by immune people. And so you don't get outbreaks. What that means is that you don't necessarily need to vaccinate everyone. There's this threshold that you need to reach. And that threshold depends actually on how infectious the disease is. Something like measles, which spreads really easily. Each case of measles can create 16 or 18 new cases. requires a very high percentage. For seasonal influenza, you might only need to vaccinate 30% of the population. For SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, we need to vaccinate, their varying estimates. Some people say 67%. I think the number is probably going to be closer to 50% before we reach, you know, herd immunity. But it's going to take time to vaccinate whatever the minimum percentage of people is, 50, 60, or 70%. Right now, we've just invented the vaccine. We have to manufacture millions of doses. Each person might need two doses. So that's 600 million doses in this country. We need to distribute those doses, which is not easy. And most importantly, we need to persuade Americans to accept the vaccine. And I think all of that's going to take at least 9 months, maybe a year. We'll reach the end of 2021. It'll be the beginning of 2022 before we reach this herd immunity threshold due to vaccination. But the irony is, meanwhile, while we're doing all that, the virus is still spreading. So the point is, you know, by the time we reach the beginning of 2022, we'll have reached this important milestone, this herd immunity milestone, either because at least, let's say, 50% of people have been vaccinated, so we'll reach this threshold artificially, or we'll reach it naturally through the natural spread of the virus.
When I'm looking forward to that time, and I'm feeling optimistic, I daydream about going to a restaurant. I think about what it would be like to get a haircut, to travel yes. like I used to go to the gym. Yes. And then when I'm at my worst, I actually wonder if any of those things that brought me joy before the pandemic will even be the same when this is over. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that things have shifted so much in the past 10 months or a year.
Yes.
How could we ever really go back? I mean, what do you think the enduring impact of this virus will be on us as people?
Right. Well, I mean, there's two parts to your question there. The first part is, how will the coming years unfold? So until we reach herd immunity, we're still going to be living in a changed world, wearing masks, avoiding gatherings, engaged in physical distancing. There'll be periodic school closures or business closures. So this immediate period, we're going to still be, let's say, under the epidemiological thumb of the virus until we reach this important herd immunity threshold. Now, we still have to recover psychologically, socially, and economically. We have millions of children who have missed school. We have tens of millions of Americans out of work. We have millions of businesses that have permanently closed. We have borrowed tons of money. We have rejiggered our lives. And to unwind a lot of those things and cope with them will take time. So then we're going to have this intermediate pandemic period. I think, looking at centuries of the history of plagues, that period will take a year or two. So I think that gets us to the end of 2023, the beginning of 2024, before we really enter the post-pandemic period. And then I think it'll be a little bit like the Roaring Twenties 100 years ago after the 1918 pandemic.
So you've talked about the physical, but also in some sense, I wonder about the spiritual, because I don't think we've fully reckoned yet with the grief and the sadness of this pandemic.
I think the thing that's important to realize is that these experiences that we're having, the death of doctors, the feeling of loss, the loss of life, the loss of livelihoods, the loss of our way of life, about which we grieve, these feelings of blaming other people, or this exacerbation of socioeconomic inequality that the plague is bringing, all of these things which seem so unfair or unnatural or alien, the thing you have to remember is that plagues are not new to our species. They're just new to us. This sense of grief that you mentioned has been described for hundreds of years during times of plague. Plagues are in the Bible. They're in the opening of Homer's Iliad. They're in Shakespeare, in Cervantes. I mean, they are a part of the human experience. And as such, they elicit very deep and fundamental human sentiments, like grief, like fear, like denial, but also like hope and optimism and love and other good feelings too. So it's complicated.
Yeah, it is. And let's just try to put this into some more historical context. You write in the book that some plagues have lasted for a very long time. The bubonic plague, 1,400 years, and another iteration of it, I believe it was the Black Death, lasted on and off for 500 years.
Yes.
And yet we're surprised every time anew when one comes.
Yes. One thing which we have to sort of recognize about this virus is that, bad as it is, it's not as bad as these historic plagues. I mean, bubonic plague would kill 50% or 80% of people in a city in a very short order. Smallpox outbreaks among Native American populations would wipe them out, 95% of people dying. Ebola outbreaks in modern West Africa could sometimes reach attack rates and lethality rates of 80%. So this SARS-CoV-2 virus is bad, but nowhere near as bad as these historical plagues. But here's the thing. This virus could have been much more lethal. We're lucky. We're actually lucky it's not worse. And so this is why for many years, the government thankfully has been preparing for global respiratory pandemics. And it's also why I'm so disappointed, candidly, in how we as a nation have done.
So when you put it that way, it makes me wonder if a contingent of people throughout history have always thought the pandemic or a pandemic was a hoax or a conspiracy of some kind. How have people seen this issue through time?
Thank you for mentioning that, because just like grief and the blaming of other people and some of those phenomena have been timeless, so have denial and lies. And in some ways, it's very human, right? I mean, nobody wants to believe that a plague is happening. I mean, denial is a very primitive and fundamental human defense. And lying about it has been seen, you know, from time immemorial. But this is why I had hoped for better from us. You know, I had hoped that as a rich, open democracy, you know, with the world's best scientists and the modern media, that, you know, we have reliable sources of information. And this is why I was hoping that with this plague, we might have seen a bit less superstition, a bit less lying, and a bit less denial.
Well, and then I hate to end this way, but you remind me that once we're on the other side of this crisis, there's no guarantee. In fact, there's a promise that it will happen again.
Yes. I mean, respiratory pandemics come every 10 or 20 years. Serious ones like the one we're in come only, you know, once every century or so. That's just on average. I mean, there's no guarantee we won't have another serious epidemic in 5 or 10 or 20 years. But I want to say something about grounds for hope and optimism, because I think one of the things you need to understand is that the virus is exploiting very deep and fundamental aspects of our common humanity. It exploits our desire to touch and hug each other. It exploits our desire to befriend each other and spend time in groups. It takes advantage of our ignorance, and therefore it is refuted by knowledge and by the sharing of accurate information. So you could even say that the spread of germs is the price we pay for the spread of ideas. What this means is that you can turn that thing on its head, and what you can recognize is it is equally through the spread of ideas that we are going to beat the spread of germs. We're going to beat this virus precisely by working together, precisely by sharing information, precisely by recognizing we all have a shared interest in what happens to all of us.
Nicholas Christakis, medical doctor, sociologist at Yale, in these trying times, I should say to you, Happy New Year. I hope it is. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me, and likewise to you and everyone listening.
Transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. 5 million people have already traveled through U.S. airports since Friday, despite the CDC warning again about traveling for the holiday. What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, as it's been the whole pandemic, when you get into these holiday periods, more people than at other points during the pandemic traveling, although far fewer people than usual. AAA's forecast for holiday travel sees more of a drop-off for this travel period, Christmas and New Year's, than for Thanksgiving. AAA says that's partly because of the nature of travel. Thanksgiving, everybody runs to their families, almost everybody in America. For this travel period, yeah, a lot of people celebrate Christmas, but other people typically do other things, go to maybe attractions that, well, aren't as attractive this time. So there's hope that at least percentage-wise, this will be down, hope from a public health standpoint, if not from a standpoint of the travel industry, obviously rebounding.
But I know that some health officials are concerned, though, that the Christmas holiday is longer than the Thanksgiving holiday, and that could cause some problems.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a question of sort of weighing those two considerations that on one hand, there's just kind of not as much to do this time of the things that people typically do. A lot of people anyway typically do this time. But no question, schools are now closed, not only for in-person learning, but virtual as well in many cases. And yeah, there's that concern that people could venture out. Public health authorities warning very much against that, saying, hey, hopefully just another few months here and we'll all be able to get vaccinated. Hang in there and don't have any people die unnecessarily.
Hang in there. Meanwhile, Seth, I'm sure you saw this story. United Airlines announced this week that a man who died aboard a flight to Los Angeles earlier this month had tested positive for COVID-19, and he had apparently told the airline that he was symptom-free because, as you know, they ask you before you get on the plane. This is kind of a scary reminder that those screenings the airlines are doing are really on the honor system.
No different, Peter, from all the years where we've had to say, yeah, nobody who we didn't know gave us something to put in our luggage, for example. It's right, just another yeah. layer of hopefully instilling a conscience in people that they should come forward if they know something. But by no means is it any kind of guarantee. The coroner in New Orleans, where the flight landed, confirmed that the man had COVID-19. But yeah, reports that his wife knew at the time that he had tested positive. He seemed to have a heart attack. That's what everybody thought. And all the people helping him then were apparently exposed to COVID.
Well, I mean, good point. Passengers were actually giving chest compressions to this man. Do we know how the people on the flight are doing? Have the airlines or anybody, the government, done any contact tracing?
Well, the airline, United, said that it provided the passenger information to the CDC, which is what typically happens, and then it's up to the CDC to go and do that contact tracing. But in fact, several passengers who were on the flight and in fact sitting very close to the man have told media, the New York Times reported one couple sitting across the aisle from him, had not been contacted.
All right. Well, Seth, that is something for people to think about as they're getting on airplanes this holiday season. I mean, there's no guarantee that the person sitting next to you on that airplane is COVID-free. Something to think about. Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you very much for your time and happy holidays to you.
Likewise, Peter. Happy holidays. Stay safe.
The chief of police of Columbus, Ohio, has relieved a police officer of duty after the fatal shooting of a 47-year-old unarmed black man early Tuesday morning, 3 weeks after the police shooting death of a 23-year-old black man in the same city. And in both cases, there are questions about a lack of body camera video. In Tuesday morning's incident, the officer was wearing a camera but didn't activate it before the shooting. A month ago, a sheriff deputy involved in the shooting of the 23-year-old was not wearing a camera. Reporter Nick Evans from member station WOSU was here. And Nick, the victim from early yesterday morning has not been identified, but officers were responding to a call about a suspicious car. There is video from the scene. What do we know?
Right. Well, we don't know quite everything yet. We're expecting to get the body camera footage this afternoon. The one disturbing element here is that, you know, the officers involved did not turn on their cameras until after the shots were fired. It's continuously recording like 60 seconds and then overriding that. So we have 60 seconds of video of the interaction, but no audio.
Well, what does the video tell us, if anything, about this man who was shot?
What we know is that there was apparently someone at their garage and then someone was shot. We don't know if the person shot was coming out of the garage or coming out of the car.
What is the rule? Is there a requirement for police officers? Are they supposed to flip their cameras on?
Yeah, absolutely. It is department policy that for any interaction that they're going to have with the public, any sort of call that they're going out on, they're supposed to turn on their camera. In this case, one would think that, you know, getting out of your cruiser on a non-emergency call, I mean, that should probably be the time to do so.
Yeah. This is the second fatal shooting in a month by law enforcement right. in your city. A sheriff deputy shot and killed 23-year-old Casey Goodson Jr., a young man with no criminal record. In that case, there's no video at all and no witnesses. Is that because a sheriff's deputy doesn't wear a camera?
Yes, absolutely. The sheriff himself released a statement basically, you know, echoing one of the things that we continually hear from law enforcement, that these cameras are a means of actually vindicating them in these sorts of circumstances. But of course, in the Columbus Police instance, the camera itself wasn't turned on.
Yeah. Well, both Columbus Police and the U.S. Attorney's Office are investigating the shooting of the 23-year-old. But how are people reacting to these two shootings in 1 month?
Absolute frustration and anger. I mean, the mayor during yesterday's press conference, he seemed probably more angry than I've seen him ever before. He said that, you know, the city is just exhausted with this string of, you know, stories that sort of echo what we saw with, you know, George Floyd, where, you know, there's just these examples where, you know, you want to treat every instance as a separate event, but they all seem to sort of rhyme in a way.
Yeah. And are we hearing from the police about the difficulty of having to, you know, think to turn on a camera when it was supposed to be a simple call? Or I don't know. Are there police speaking out?
About this particular case, not yet. The police have been coordinating response pretty thoroughly in this instance. Mm. It's all kind of coming in a pretty limited and controlled fashion.
That's reporter Nick Evans of WOSU. Thank you so much, Nick.
Happy to do it.
Well, changing gears now to consider cities in winter. Last fall, we told you about Chicago's Winter Dining Challenge to get ideas for COVID-era outdoor restaurant dining, igloos, and space heaters. Today, a competition for winter placemaking to bring foot traffic to entire main streets in colder months through winter activations like plowing snow to make walls and clearing bike paths. They got 65 entries from 6 countries. The contest came from Bench Consulting, where Jonathan Burke is creative director. He joins us by Skype. And Jonathan, you put out a call for designs for Saline Main Street in Saline, Michigan, downtown Winnipeg in Manitoba, Canada, and Eggleston Square in Boston, or a street of their choice. What'd you get?
You saw some more traditional thinkings around the holiday markets and the Kringle markets, but some other really innovative ideas of, you know, we have all these Christmas trees and holiday trees and evergreen trees out. So using evergreen trees as a wind block and also using snow.
Well, I love this. Snow can hold in warmth and it can form walls.
The value of snow that we saw in some of the submissions was wind blocking. It serves to kind of deflect some of the prevailing winds up and over people who are gathered outdoors. It also can add to the mood, right? I mean, we're talking with folks down in some cities in southern Massachusetts, in New Bedford, for instance, about actually investing in snow making equipment to try and bring in some snow in some of the warmer winters.
You also had an admission based on the Scandinavian thinking of, I think I'm going to pronounce this correctly, hygge, spelled H-Y-G-G-E. This is a concept of coziness and wellness. We all know Scandinavian design is just so exquisite and simple, but it's about creating an outdoor winter living room placed on a main street.
It's a mentality of kind of creating more of a sense of place and holiness outside in your communities. And I think we can really learn from some of the Scandinavians in all of our cities and towns. It can be a simple concept. It can be simple as personal warmth, as dressing warm in layers to kind of get outdoors. It can also be as detailed like adding some fire pits and warming stations and warm adult beverages to your main street and getting people outdoors with some simple concepts.
Well, interestingly, some of the ideas are based on what's already being done in cities like Edmonton, Alberta. But we learn that Edmonton actually only changed their thinking about winter, you know, it not being a time to hibernate, 8 years ago. And now they have fire pits and ice rinks and movies projected on a snow screen. They hand out blankets, tell the local meteorologists to be more chipper about cold weather, frame it in a different way. Tell us some more of the ideas.
Edmonton has really sort of set the bar when it comes to winter in cities. They've hired a person full-time on staff, a winter city planner, Ila Tanaka, who's just incredible at thinking holistically about the entire city of Edmonton to embrace winter. Outdoor patios at restaurants are a thing, encouraging restaurant owners, instead of trying to enclose those spaces, make them winter patios, stand-up tables and change the food offerings and change the drink offerings and really do things to encourage people outdoors. She really experimented up there with different lighting styles. Colorful lighting in the darker months can make folks feel a little bit warmer, improves happiness. I think the biggest thing we learned from them and the biggest surprise they had was that they thought people would not embrace winter, that it'd be a difficult thing to do to get people to change the mentality. And almost overnight, people all of a sudden came out to all of these different events and these things to do. And she was amazed, I think, at the response. And we've worked with a number of cities and towns across the country in the last few months to really rethink what their traditional holiday events are and make it more of a weekend by weekend event, or more of a routine on a weekly basis, as opposed to just a one-off. What we're doing with a lot of cities is encouraging fire pits spread out throughout the downtown area to provide that space for warmth, but not necessarily encourage people to huddle and stay around too long, but encourage them to kind of come warm up for a few minutes and then move on to the next station from there. These are things that Canadian cities have been doing for years. Montreal's had it for years. Calgary this winter is really leading the way in terms of how they think about public opportunities in their public parks. They're actually stationing free fire pits with firewood in all of their parks and just letting residents and community groups come out and actually make their own fire pits. They're kind of pushing the limits a little bit and saying, you know what, this is an unprecedented year. We want to try to encourage people to have these social gatherings that we know will happen indoors, even in small groups, and do it outdoors.
Edmonton keeps parks and golf courses open and the snow groomed for cross-country skiing and snowshoeing. In Boston, down in the seaport, you can go curling. You mentioned things like warming huts and light shows. You know, there's some towns that are putting beautiful either ice sculptures or light shows along a main street so families can just come and look at the beautiful lights. It gets complicated. Epidemiologists worry that people might huddle too close around a fire pit or have a false sense of safety in, say, a selfie booth. Warming huts sound like a wonderful idea, but, you know, a city may have a homeless population that understandably would want to move in. But, you know, a lot of health officials are applauding this because it gets people out. If they can socially distance and wear a mask, you're healthier walking down a main street instead of sitting on a couch.
Yeah, we've heard from a number of epidemiologists. Like, obviously, there's concerns around crowding. We caution folks that make sure you're working directly with boards of health. I'm working with a couple of communities that have postponed different winter activations because of rising case counts based on conversations with their local boards of health. So I think it's a city by city and a case by case basis as to how cities and communities handle it. But I think overall, we talk about trying to get people outside this winter from a mental health standpoint, from a physical health standpoint. It's really, I think, preferred for most epidemiologists over keeping people indoors. For the long term, too, trying to encourage folks, you know what, winter doesn't necessarily have to be the forgotten season in cities.
That's Jonathan Burke, Creative Director at Bench Consulting, telling us about their Winter Places contest. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org. Jonathan, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin. I appreciate it.
When President Franklin Delano Roosevelt took office, he was facing record unemployment, widespread deforestation, and the catastrophe of the Dust Bowl. In response to the economic and environmental challenges, FDR established the Civilian Conservation Corps, known as the Tree Army. It gave 3 million men new jobs and created thousands of parks across the country. Now, some are calling for a modern version of the CCC. The Allegheny Front's Andy Kubis has the story.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt introduced the idea of a Civilian Conservation Corps to the nation in his second fireside chat, broadcast by radio across the country on May 7, 1933.
And in creating this Civilian Conservation Corps, we are killing two birds with one stone. We are clearly enhancing the value of our natural resources, and at the same time, we are relieving an appreciable amount of actual distress.
3 months later, a 500,000 young men were enrolled in the CCC. It is said to be the fastest mobilization in American history, far outpacing enrollment for either of the world wars, and has never been matched since.
We didn't have food. We didn't have jobs. I don't think people realize how close this nation came to having a revolution.
This is the late Harley Joly recalling his time at the CCC for a documentary that aired on PBS in 2009. He joined the Corps when he was 18 years old.
So we CCCers came along as the first environmentalists.
As part of Roosevelt's Tree Army, Joly was issued work gloves and two uniforms. He received 3 meals a day and a bed in the barracks. Pay was $30 a month, but 25 of that was sent home to help his family. He spent the 8-hour workdays planting trees, cutting miles of trails, and helping build structures like cabins, dams, and lakes.
So here we are at Cooser Lake. It was originally built by the CCC as an earth and log lake.
Ashley Berry is a park ranger here at the Laurel Hill State Park Complex in southwestern Pennsylvania. She says this is a perfect picnic spot now, but it wasn't so picturesque when the first CCC boys arrived on June 10th, 1933.
This land was completely barren. There were no trees, there was no lake, maybe a trickle of a stream running through here, but really it was just a wasteland.
In the late 1800s and early 1900s, logging and mining companies clear-cut giant swaths of land across the country. The CCC crews were sent in to help restore the land.
They planted trees and shrubs. They did a lot of soil erosion work and fire control, flood control, things like that. They really worked to restore the natural resources that had been so severely depleted. And nationwide, they employed 3 million men and planted over 3 billion trees.
Well, that's a lot of trees.
That's a lot of trees. They were actually responsible for more than 50% of the reforestation across the country.
The value of the work done by the CCC crews nationwide is estimated at $8 billion. And now some congressional Democrats are talking about reviving the program to tackle both unemployment and environmental issues. Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania is one of them.
I think it's not only a great idea, it's an idea whose time has come. Frankly, it's an idea whose urgency is upon us, maybe even without the pandemic, but ever more so in the aftermath of the pandemic.
Senator Casey is currently drafting legislation for a 21st century CCC program that he's planning to introduce soon.
I can hear the howls from some in Washington saying, oh my goodness, you mean you're going to use federal dollars to hire people? And I say, damn right, got to do it. There's no way we can wait for some package of incentives to, you know, kickstart a full, robust recovery.
There have been other state and federal programs modeled after the CCC over the years, but what Casey is proposing is the most ambitious. In addition to conservation work, his proposal would provide labor to help farmers adopt agriculture practices, which improve soil and increase resilience to climate change. And unlike the original program, which was segregated, the new version would be open to people of all ages and backgrounds, and workers would get a living wage.
We need solutions as big as the challenges we face.
Colin O'Meara is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation.
The Civilian Conservation Corps is exactly the type of proven, bold idea that can deliver opportunities for hardworking Americans all across the country from all backgrounds while restoring our parks, our public lands, our water, and our wildlife.
O'Meara says the pandemic has pushed people outside in unprecedented numbers. State and national parks have had record visitors, but they also have infrastructure and maintenance backlogs in the billions.
Does that fireplace still work?
Back at Laurel Hill State Park, Ashley Berry stops at the Mighty Oak Pavilion, built by the CCC crews 87 years ago.
Look at that. It is absolutely gorgeous.
The stone and wood pavilion is nestled back in the woods and is supported by what looks like whole tree trunks. Berry says it's hard to believe it was made with simple tools and materials found nearby.
For some boys who had so very little, they truly did so very much for us. We can see that in all of our state parks across Pennsylvania, the legacy that they left behind, and I hope that we continue to cherish that.
Berry says they're expecting a lot of visitors this winter for snowshoeing and cross-country skiing. She hopes they enjoy and respect the landscape preserved decades ago by FDR's Tree Army. For Here and Now, I'm Andy Kubis.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Has been a tumultuous year, starting, of course, with the global pandemic. World News in Review with Christiane Amanpour next time on Here and Now.